So, yeah, I'm Ed Marone, and I wrote Legacy of War. And I'm going to talk about the beginnings of the book, how I got there, and if we have time, maybe touch base on PTSD, because there is a subplot to the book that deals with post-traumatic stress disorder. So in 2009, about 40 years after I served in Vietnam, I went to Vietnam for a vacation. And the idea was that I'm going to see the country that I fought a war in. And the Socialist Republic of Vietnam, that's a unified country now, no more North or South Vietnam, it's one country. And the capital is still Hanoi. And I flew into Hanoi. Now, Hanoi was never on our books. You couldn't cross the DMZ, but we bombed it extensively during the war. And my concern was, once I landed, I had a private guide. My wife was with me, and we landed, and I met, it was a young woman, or probably in her 30s, 40s, and she becomes a character in my book. Her name is Wee, H-I-E-U. In the book, though, I make her a gorgeous-looking Eurasian. So, you know, I have the liberty of being a writer in that case, okay? But she was a nice person. And my concern was, when I landed in Vietnam again, how would our former enemies deal with me? Because now we're talking to generational issues. You have some that lost their fathers, their brothers, their uncles, all ages. And would they look at this American? And most Vietnamese are about 5'4", and I'm about 6 foot. And, you know, we're Caucasian, they're brown skin, and so you're easy to spot. You don't get lost in the crowd. And there's a little funny tidbit in the book where the character John Moore has to wear a New York Yankees baseball cap so he could be identified among the Vietnamese police and military that he's working with. And he always makes this comment, how hard is it to find me? I'm sticking out like a sore thumb in this group. So anyway, that planted the seeds for the novel. I thought it'd be interesting to compare what happened to Americans and Vietnamese after the war and trying to work together to solve a war crime. And, you know, war crimes do happen. And that was the essence of the plot. And if I was to sum it up, Book Life, which is Publisher Weekly, they said, Legacy War is a well-researched and tightly plotted novel that will have readers turning the pages to find out how decades ago, along a decade's plot for revenge turns out. And the key is revenge. That is one of the key plots in the book, and it comes to fruition at the end. So you have to read the book to see what the revenge was all about. And the novel is not a war novel. It's not a caricature of history, but rather looks back at Vietnam to show how it affected personal lives and culture at large. It took me 10 years to write. I had many versions of the manuscript. I struggled through different things. And if I was in an elevator with my agent or an editor and I had to make a quick pitch about the book, this is my 30-second elevator pitch. A new patient triggers psychologist John Moore's traumatic memories of the Vietnam War. Moore is then forced to return to modern-day Vietnam to confront his past war demons from the killing fields. A rogue CIA agent, a corrupt South Vietnamese army officers, there were two of them, and the father he never knew, and the war's killing machine, the Phoenix Program, which is run by the CIA. In the decaying jungles, he fights his anguish, compounded by his wife's death and his growing attraction to a national police officer, the Lady Wee. Okay? So the book starts off to lay the plot. It's John Moore is a captain. He just served his full year tour in Vietnam. He jumps on a helicopter that happens to pick him up after he turned over his combat command, and he's going back home. He's going to go to Cameron Bay and catch what they call the Freedom Bird back to the States, or what we call the world. And Moore, this is written in first person, so John Moore says in his story, "I almost killed him. Stand down, I ordered. The helicopter blade sliced through the thick humid air over war-weary Vietnam at 3,000 feet. The trademark whooping sound of the Huey UH-1 oppressed my eardrums as I pulled my .45 caliber pistol from its black holster. Its safety off, I pointed it at the CIA agent, Ramsey. He hesitated, alarming me. Seconds pass. Then with dejection, he released his hold on the POW, prisoner of war, dropping the North Vietnamese Army officer, we called him the NVA, lieutenant, onto the Huey's vibrating floor. The POW slid himself over to his fellow countryman, a full NVA colonel. Both POWs stared at me, but the colonel's eyes acted as if he recognized me. His lips mouthed something I didn't understand. Unnerved, I returned my focus to the CIA agent, who uttered an obscenity. The noise of the helicopter drowned out whatever he said. At that moment, the Huey UH-1 descended to fly nap of the earth, trying to avoid being targeted by NVA machine guns in the thick jungle below. Ramsey stepped back from the open door through which he had attempted to toss the POW and sat back on his bench seat across from me, his supplicating hands free of any weapons, his 30 caliber carbine at his feet. His distress seemed genuine, but I couldn't be certain. So this first page sets the tone. John Moore is a captain. He swore an oath to serving the country, Constitution, and to uphold the laws of the nation. And in this, Moore has a dilemma. According to the Geneva Convention, you don't kill unarmed combatants. Certainly not like this, not toss them from a helicopter. And so Moore has to take a stand, and he did. And that describes the character, what Moore is. He's ethical, he's honest, he has standards. And certainly he didn't expect on his last day or two in country to be confronted in a situation like this when he's headed home to the world. So the chapter introduces four characters. You got, besides Moore, who's the main character, you got the two prisoner of wars. They come back in his life as part of the revenge. And also, one of the bad South Vietnamese army officers is on board with the CIA agent, Ramsey. So those two also come back to haunt him later on, long after the war. And as the plot develops, they interact with him as he then, after his later day session after this recall, Moore is sitting with his PTSD patient, which he shouldn't have been counseling or didn't want to counsel, in Charlotte, North Carolina, long after the war. And that PTSD patient forces a recall, as I described in the 30-second pitch. And this PTSD patient then ends up committing suicide. And that starts a whole scenario of events that forces Moore to try to find out why. Why did it happen? Because, you know, Moore is considered himself a pretty good psychologist, and he doesn't understand how he missed the suicide, if there was a suicide attempt on the part of the patient. And so he ends up going back to D.C. to talk with his friends and people that he has contact. And I use the flashback process for Moore to go back to war for a brief second, and it helps build up what Moore is struggling with as he deals with the emotions of the killing fields of Vietnam. And he's driving in Washington, D.C., and he's thinking, we lived and fought in a steamy jungle and on the plateaus, enmeshed in the pungent smells of the jungle decay, feeling the grit meld with our unwashed bodies, enduring the heavy humid air, hearing the forest creatures in their domain, and seeing death regularly, friends and foes grotesquely molded in their final poses. So Moore is constantly being hit with these recalls, and that also describes the mental condition of him. I leave it up to the readers to decide if he has a variation of PTSD or not, but it's certainly the war demons impact him, but it also drives him to help solve why all this, the war crime itself happened, and how he got stuck trying to bring the bad guys to justice. And so that pretty much is the plot. I hope it's enticing enough that people read it. Like I said, it isn't a war novel because it interrelates with the Vietnamese culture. He interrelates with the Vietnamese officers and enlisted people, some who don't accept him because he's an American and he was part of the reason they lost family members. And he struggles with all this to deal with it. And one of the things that is a subplot to this, as I was talking earlier, is the PTSD effect, the post-traumatic stress disorder. I did PTSD voluntary counseling for the Department of Veteran Affairs, and in that time frame, we had 12 people in the group that had PTSD. And as I said earlier, the PTSD can be seen in five different variables or symptoms that come out to play. One is the heavy use of drugs like alcohol and heavy duty drugs, cocaine, heroin, whatever. Not everybody that has PTSD resorts to that, but that is one of the symptoms. And another one is interpersonal relations or lack of, their inability to talk about their problems with their loved ones, especially the wife. And the wife can be a good sounding board, but a lot of the particularly Vietnam vets coming back never experienced the ability to talk to their wives, nor wanted to. And it would have helped a lot in their PTSD recovery. And another one was the psychosomatic symptoms, the physiological breakdown of people from mental health, i.e. High blood pressure, as I pointed out, is a good example. Mental health does cause your body to wear down and can cause certain diseases. And then the last two, and these are probably the red flags of PTSD, despair and depression. A lot of times you have to have drugs to treat that because they can lead, if they become severe, they can lead to suicide. And so that's what doing a counseling session in a group was all about. And I learned a lot from that. The VA had asked me to do that from the point of view that I served in combat in Vietnam. I was a young captain when I was there, but I didn't exhibit any issues. But at least I understood what combat was about. And there is no real, I could find anything that documents final or effective cure of PTSD. It's a process of dealing with it. There are all kinds of magic bullets being talked about. But if you have anxiety, you take anxiety pills like lorazepam and so on. And that helps. But the key is talking about the issues of PTSD. You know, what caused you to think about the war? What caused you to think about that event? It could have been a simple thing like a 4th of July fireworks and the crackers, you know, the firecrackers going off, causing a guy to just go somewhere and hide. And in fact, some of the guys in my PTSD group never went out during the 4th of July. They just hunkered down in their basement. They didn't want that noise. They just wanted quiet. They didn't need that. And also the helicopter, UH-1, which was a common transportation tool for all of us. The whopping sound of those blades, you know, that when you do a lot of air assaults, like I did with the 101st, they're familiar to you. You live with them. And then when you hear them in peacetime, as they're being phased out now, you got the new Blackhawks and everything else. But those Hueys could also trigger, for some guys, a recall of events, the traumatic events in the war. So there are a lot of things that will cause the recall. But the way we dealt with it was to record and discuss the events in the open in the group. And there are similarities among everybody. Everybody had a different story. But the key was to alleviate that problem to the point that you can live with it and decrease the impact on you. And it's possible. Some guys couldn't cope with it. They're the ones early on committed suicide, not necessarily in my group, but in overall in U.S., as we talk about suicide before. And so that is always a problem. And the key to all this is trying to talk through the issues and heal through good interpersonal relationships. And it works in most cases, but I don't think there is an ultimate cure. It's one of those things that your mind either suppresses or represses. And repression is the what I call the subconscious. It's back there somewhere. Your mind had such a shock in the war that it hid it in one of these dark chambers. And if it never comes out, that's good. But usually leaks out during your dreams. And then you need to bring it out and talk about it to make it less severe, because you're no longer in combat. Now we can deal with it and talk about it and try to rationalize some of the things. So that's it. Any questions? The Vietnam War, it was different in the time frame. When we got back from Vietnam, different times. I came back in 70. But throughout that war, you had the U.S. or the citizen base was split. You had pro and con, and pretty soon the troops felt that they were being wasted. They weren't being used because no one seemed to be unified for whatever they were there for. I remember how I dealt with it. I was sworn as a young captain to serve the country. I never thought about it because I spent all my time in jungle, so I didn't get involved with the politics. You know, the Stars and Stripes didn't talk about how corrupt the South Vietnamese government was or how bad the North Vietnamese government was. You fought your war. But and nowadays, we're having a high suicide rate in the military, active duty. We have about 312 in 2018, that active duty military, not vets, retired or otherwise, active duty military that committed suicide. And that's a record that equals the record of 2012. It was 312 back then. It's 312 in 2018. We don't know what 2019, because it's not over with yet. But to commit suicide, there's something going on. And it's either the maturity or too many tours for the same guys over and over. You know, there's got to be something in military medical team profession evaluates to try to come up with a solution for it. I would favor a draft system to serve the country, because you get everybody exposed to war and pretty soon, or serving, and pretty soon you have a cohesion that helps bond. I think one of the things too, and I'm going to take a leap, I don't know much about the Israeli army, but I would speculate that when they serve with their unit for the period, whatever it is. In Vietnam, because of, as I was pointing out earlier, the medical profession decided that one way to alleviate the old shell shock combat fatigue syndrome was to have a term of service. And for Vietnam is 1 year and you're back, you're rotated back to get back to normal and all that. But if you keep sending troops back and back and back, you don't have that stability. And plus, we were faced with high rotation. My unit would see new recruits coming in all the time, either to replace the dead or the wounded, or just guy was rotating back. You know, his 365 days were up. He was headed home. We needed to fill that slot. So it's constant commotion. And so there's an interplay with that too, where the old guys, what we call the older guys, you know, they're 19 or 20, they'd served like 6 months already. And here comes a newbie, a new guy, just shipped in from the States. The oldies, the old guys, didn't want anything to do with the newbie. First of all, they worried about him getting them killed because he's so green. And what happens to the newbie, he feels alone, isolated. I mean, talk about there's no unit support internally. And as the commander, you try to do what you can, but day in, day night, when they're in the trenches or sleeping in their sleeping bags or whatever together, this poor guy is ostracized until he proves himself months later that he can handle a weapon, that he will not cause the older guy, to get killed, because they're all counting on the short timer's calendar. You know, they want to get home. And so I think there's a lot of that. And I think in World War II is a good example. The units went over en masse. The Idaho Falls, or the Idaho National Guard, the 116th, was one of the three units, National Guard units, that were deployed as in totality. They went over together, they served together, and they came back together. Very few, other than maybe the casualties, any replacements were, you didn't have rotation. They served their full 12 months or whatever they were there for, but they came back as a unit. And I'll tell you, in a military, unit is everything. It keeps your sanity, it keeps you going. You have an infrastructure, a support system. Usually your officer is squared away. I hope I was, but you know, you're dealing with other problems when you don't have a standard, a cohesive unit all the time.